All right, so today we're going to start exploring next couple days, so today and tomorrow, and maybe a little bit Monday depending. I mean, my plan is today and tomorrow to make up for the Friday not being available. We're going to explore what I promised as block two, that was called entanglement harvesting and entanglement farming. Now, what is this? Well, this is just, you know, the kind of picture that you use for, I don't know, to when someone asks you, oh, what is it that you do? Well, look at that picture. Oh, wow, that's kind of cool. But anyway, it's supposed to be an illustration of, it's in a completely different context, but it's supposed to be an illustration of microstructure that appears when you magnify too much. No, we're used to that. I mean, no matter where, pick anything in this room, and it seems homogeneous, like the board seems pretty homogeneous, the atmosphere, the gas here seems pretty homogeneous, right? But then you start magnifying, the atmosphere is a particularly bad case, a particularly ill case in the sense that it's mostly empty. And then suddenly the density, right, it got like super huge spikes when you hit a molecule or something like that. So we know that structure appears when we magnify. And classically we can think, oh yeah, sure, but if you have actually nothing, you have a vacuum, then you won't see much because there's nothing in there. However, we know from quantum theory that actually not having anything, it's only kind of true on average. As in like, yeah, I could be in a global ground state, as in like as homogeneous as it gets, and also stationary, eigenstate of whatever the Hamiltonian of the theory is in the ground state. But if I start magnifying, it's not true that I'm gonna see nothing. We discussed already a little bit, when we just magnify, if we want, to two regions, two wedges in flat space-time, and we have a quantum field in the global vacuum there, we realize that the state in one wedge is definitely not looking like the vacuum. Okay, like the vacuum, like empty, all right? So, yeah, if you magnify this, you've heard often, probably, people talking about, yeah, when you start magnifying, particles start popping up and things like that, no? That kind of like lay description of what really goes on. What really goes on, you will do a tutorial and a problem about, actually, that about this, like what would a detector see depending on the scales of switch on and switch off and how big they are and things like those. Huh? We're gonna see that. So you're gonna practice that with your hands, all right? But I think that by now you're probably pretty much convinced that a particle detector can see stuff, even if you prepare the ground state of the theory it is coupled to. Not within the approximations that are common in quantum optics, such as rotating wave approximation, but if you don't do them, there is stuff that is seen when you couple a detector to the vacuum. So just as a little bit of a reminder. And now let's present the phenomenology that I'm gonna talk about. So imagine that you have, say, two particle detectors, could be two atoms, two hydrogen atoms, whatever you want. Something that couples to the quantum field and is localized in time and space. And then you couple it to the quantum field for a finite time. Say that the amount of time is the length of the sphere in that direction. And then you uncouple it. So you initially you have two atoms. These two atoms come from here, of course, from the past. And the word lines go like this. And they interact with the field. This one interacts with the field in this region, in space and time. And the other one interacts with the field in the region that I can't really reach with my arm, but I have the hockey stick, yeah. In this region here. And they originally start unentangled. Well, in fact, they start uncorrelated, completely uncorrelated, in a product state. No information of one in the other. Okay, there's no information that you can get about one measuring the other. Now, we let them evolve, couple to the quantum field, and then I tell you, oh, after the interaction, they get entangled. Perhaps you wouldn't be too surprised, would you? No, in this scheme. Why? Because, well, typical reasoning would be, well, yeah, this one couples here, this one couples here. Yeah, maybe it's weird if they both start in the ground state and the field is in the ground state, but well, okay, there's a perturbation here, the perturbation like photons from this person propagates to the other one, And then, well, yeah, through that interaction, through the exchange of information, through the exchange of quanta, if you want, they get entangled. Would that be surprising to you? How many people would be surprised by that? That I can get two atoms to interact with a quantum field like that and get them remotely entangled? How surprising is that? How many people are surprised? How many people are not surprised? Okay, good. I don't think it's surprising either. I mean, if you think about it and actually compute it and so on, it is, because your expectation from quantum optics, if you do the approximation, the usual ones, is that nothing happens. Because, you know, say that they are in the ground state, the two atoms, and they feel in the ground state, and still. But anyway, yeah, it's kind of not surprising, I would say. Scenario number two. We have two detectors. And then we get the two detectors originally in a completely uncorrelated state. Okay? And they only interact with the field, this one in this region, this one in this region. As you can see, the two detectors during their interaction remain at all times space-like separated. Okay? So they cannot exchange information. They just can't. All right? Information will never reach from detector one, will never reach detector two. And then I say, okay, they start uncorrelated on this plane of simultaneity, and then I look at this plane of simultaneity and I say, oh, now they are entangled. So I tell you, through that interaction, they become entangled. They weren't at the beginning, but they are now. Here, one cannot wave their hands and say, they exchange photons, because they didn't. They are space-like separated. They exchange nothing. They might as well not know about each other's existence. In fact, they don't. We will talk a bit about that when we talk about communication too. How many people find this surprising? Right? I mean, and rightfully so. Because the reason is that we tend to think as entanglement in a system as a result of a direct interaction, right? In a way that maybe they interacted through something else, and that something else put them in contact and they exchange information, and through that, they got entangled. No? If they can never communicate, how are they going to get entangled? No? Isn't that why it's surprising? Or at least at first sight it's surprising? Well, first thing we're going to argue is that it's not surprising. But for that, let's move to atoy. Any questions so far? It seems like, really? No? Okay, that's good. That's the kind of mindset that we need for this. Let's demystify it. Imagine the following toy model. I have the someone gives me the following problem. I have a system A and B that start in a completely uncorrelated state. And I'm given the task of get them entangled. What are my resources? My resources are, well, I have access to a one-dimensional lattice of coupled harmonic oscillators. All right? This is this. And I'm allowed to do bilocal interactions. You know the word bilocal? Bilocal means that A can only couple to one element of the lattice, I. B can only couple to another element of the lattice, J, locally. They can never couple to the same elements of the lattice, and they cannot couple to more than one. Okay? So this is the task. I need to get A and B entangled, and I have this lattice, and the ability to couple A to I and B to J, all right? And there are two possible mechanisms. Mechanism number one, analogous to the two pictures that I showed you before. Mechanism number one, you couple them, then the coupling generates a perturbation, the perturbation propagates from A to B, B receives the perturbation, and through that perturbation transmitted, they get entangled, okay? So again, this is a mechanism of exchange of information. Is when you place them on the light cone of each other. They communicate via phonons, and through those phonons that they exchange from the lattice, they get entangled. That's the one that is not so surprising. But there's another one. Yeah, of course. So now, after that interaction, they get entangled. Nice. Of course, yeah, that's important, right? This is limited by the speed of sound. Of course, you cannot get them entangled through this mechanism if they cannot exchange information, okay? Possibility number two. Ha! Huh. The lattice is in the ground state. But the ground state of the whole lattice, though, you just cooled it down. The ground state of the whole lattice is not just a very, it's not an innocent state, huh? I mean, let's just target it as zero, label it as zero, and then we can ask, okay, what is that ground state? So you have two natural bases here, right? You have the normal mode basis, so you can diagonalize your Hamiltonian, right? And order the levels by energy, okay? And that's what we call normal modes when we're working with harmonic oscillators. And the normal modes, you have the ground state, the first excitation, the second excitation. Of course, they can be degenerate. So there's degeneracy in those subspaces if you want. But say that I just label them with different things. So maybe one and two have the same energy and things like that. But anyway, the ground state is just one. It's non-degenerate for a lattice of harmonic oscillators coupled like that. And they have, and we have another basis that is natural, right? Which is the local, what we call number basis. The basis that is local to every harmonic oscillator, huh? Everyone agrees with that? These two bases span the whole Hilbert space. Agreed? For the lattice. Now, the vacuum state, sorry, the ground state of the lattice is most certainly not the product of all the individual ground states. That is trivial to see, because you have an interaction. Say that the interaction is XX. The free harmonic oscillator Hamiltonians are P squared over 2m plus something proportional to X squared. The P squared part does not commute with the XX interaction part. The interaction Hamiltonian does not commute with the free Hamiltonian. Therefore, you cannot diagonalize them in the same basis. Therefore, the ground state will not be. So if the ground state is diagonal in basis 1, will not be diagonal in basis 2. The ground state is indeed not just the tensor product of all the ground states. In fact, the ground state of the lattice, so far so good? The ground state of the lattice, if you trace out the whole lattice and keep only I and J, say the subsystem IJ in the lattice, is non-separable. There are correlations between I and J because they are part of a lattice that is an interaction. So when you cool it down, the state of I and J is entangled. All right? It's non-separable. Right. So the ground state of a lattice, as you know already, though, because I discussed it like several times, I think, is non-separable bilocally. If you pick two elements on the lattice, the state of the two elements is non-separable. It's not pure either, but it's non-separable. It contains entanglement. Okay? Note of warning. If someone tells you about regions of space-time being entangled to each other, regions, not halves of space-time, being entangled to each other, and they use the entanglement entropy, call them out. The entanglement entropy is not an entanglement measure if your state is not pure, the global state. And sometimes people use it. It's common. You still see. No, they're starting not to, but at the very beginning, entanglement entropy was used for that. So anyway, note of warning. We can talk more about that if you want. So this state of I and J is a non-pure state that is entangled. Now, if there is entanglement between I and J, maybe the bilocal interaction of A with I and B with J can harvest, swap that entanglement that exists between I and J and take it for themselves. All right? The way that would look like is like, of course, locally, A and B coupled to the lattice, and they don't see anything but fluctuations. If you want ground state fluctuations, locally, they would see something. Noise, if you want, if they start collecting outcomes of measurements. But again, it's like noise. But that noise in A and B is actually correlated noise. The noise that A experiences when coupled to I and the noise that B experiences when coupled to J is not uncorrelated. And in fact, their noise that they had is strongly, well, strongly, it depends on many things. It's correlated because of that entanglement that exists on the lattice, on those correlations that exist on the lattice. So in particular, A and B can just interact for a while with I and J. And that entanglement that already exists in the ground state of the lattice, maybe they can swap them. They can swap that entanglement and take it for their own. Yes?
When you say swap, it means that then the two parts of the field are not entangled anymore?
Well, less entangled, yeah. Although in a field, talking about that is tricky, infinite dimensional and so on. But yes, we will discuss that because entanglement harvesting is the phenomenon. Entanglement farming is, let's try to use it to the max. Let's try to exhaust it and see what happens. So we will discuss that. Anyway, so yeah, there's another mechanism of getting A and B entangled that is not through exchanging quanta, if you want. It's not through exchanging information. It's just something exists already. Let's just pick it. It's a resource that's already in the ground state of the lattice. And of course, that mechanism is not limited by speed of the interaction. Because there's no communication, there's no need for communication to use that mechanism. The entanglement already existed. And that means that this is not limited by the speed of sound. So far, so good? Yes?
For the lattice to get to the ground state, would those two space-like separated regions have had to have had some time, communication in
no.
their history?
No, yes, okay. In terms of being in the lichen of each other, yeah, there's a common cause for sure. You cool it down, and the cooling it down, you need to wait until the whole system is cooled down, if you want.
So it's sort of like me telling someone something, someone giving information to two people and them going far away. And then
in a way, yeah, you can think of it like that. The thermalization process is a long distance process. So it involves everyone to reach the ground state. Yeah, indeed. All right, so now it's not so surprising. Presented the first way that I presented it, it was like, how can it be? But presented like this is like, no, well, yeah, we have a source of entanglement that is bilocal, S1, S2, if you want. S1 and S2 are entangled. And now A interacts with S1, B interacts with S2, and they swap the entanglement to A and B. Okay? Now, that was for a lattice. The mechanism for a quantum field is not unlike that. Trivially, you can actually take the continuum limit in the lattice and get a massive scalar field out of that. The mechanism that gets two atoms entangled when interacting locally with the field is very similar to the second kind of mechanism. So this is kind of similar to the first kind of mechanism. This is similar to the second kind of mechanism in that scheme. So yes, indeed, you can harvest entanglement from a quantum field. Any questions? All right.
How do you measure this entanglement?
We will get there. So in principle, you can do tomography on the full state of the atoms later and measure it. But then again, you can maybe even extract bell pairs from it. And that's definitely visible.
Oh, yes. Is it distillable? Or?
Yes, it is distillable. And that's the farming part of it. Mm-hmm. But for now, let's focus on the harvesting part. There are fundamental consequences of this. And there are some applied ones, if you want. Okay. Before that, I think that it would be a good idea that I show you a little bit of how this comes out when you actually couple detectors, all right? So maybe I'm going to put the screen up for a tiny bit, yeah, and unplug this. The calculations are a little bit long and tedious. We're not going to do them, but I'm going to give you all the instructions that you need to do them yourselves, okay? It's not difficult, so you see where it comes from. All right. So say we have two particle detectors. On, let's say, the ground state, to make it simple. Coupled to a scalar field. Vacuum, in the vacuum state. All right? So for the expressions that I'm going to give you, it's like, well, the initial state of the whole system, if you want, rho 0 as the initial state of the system, it's equal to rho detector 1, let's call it A, rho detector B, and the vacuum state of the field. I didn't specify to the ground state here. I'll do it later, because as long as I can keep writing general expressions, there's no reason why not to. Okay? So say that we have, Here I wrote a completely uncorrelated state, arbitrary state for atom A, only that is uncorrelated with everything else, arbitrary state of atom B, and the vacuum for the field. All right. All right. So let's write the interaction Hamiltonian. Might as well do it out of memory. Let's write the interaction Hamiltonian. Well, the interaction Hamiltonian, let's assume we have Andrew DeWitt detectors. So the interaction Hamiltonian, you know it well. Sam. Let me add a label that tells you what detector you're looking at. So it's the sum over the two detectors of lambda nu switching nu. Let's assume they're commoving detectors, OK? Detectors are inertial and commoving. So they share a rest frame, and that's the frame we're going to work on. Working, OK? So now you get dx n dimensions, and then you get the smearing function. Of course, this smearing function would be centered at different positions. Then we have m nu, and that couples to the field. I'm basically picking the quantization frame to be the same as the inertial commoving frame. You can always do because it's inertial. So this is the interaction Hamiltonian that we have. Then we need to compute the time evolution of the initial state. Interesting enough, of course, we can do the one of the, we're going to talk a little bit about non-perturbative results. Above all, we want to get Bell pairs out of that. But let's talk through a perturbative perspective, because it's really instructive. So if the coupling is weak, which it is in nature, then u, that is the time order exponential, of the operator that generates translations with respect to t. This I can approximate. Well, no, I'm going to write the exact expression, why not? As let's use lambda as the parameter, although keep in mind that might not be the dimensionless parameter. It is in 3D, though. All right, so we can do an expansion on this. There are several ways of doing that. How many ways do you know of doing that that are standard? There's at least, how many do you know? Have you seen an expansion like that before? You have. That's how you do perturbation theory in quantum usually. The most common one is the Dyson expansion. The second most common one is the Magnus expansion. The difference is, in the Dyson expansion, you preserve the trace. At every order in perturbation theory, you preserve probabilities. So all the traces add up to one. In the Magnus expansion, you preserve the volume of phase space. You preserve the symplectic form, if you want. So you, in one of them, you have powers of the Hamiltonian. In the other one, you have commutators. OK? I don't know if you heard about the two of them. Dyson, for sure, because that's the one that is often used in quantum field theory in general. Magnus, maybe not, but it's super useful, too, depending on what you want to do. OK? For example, for you, Kfir, what you're doing, which is like open quantum dynamics that comes out of bombardment of things like that. Expansions like Magnus are more close to what you actually get at use. All right, then. So we get an expansion like this. And let's pick the Dyson expansion. OK. The Dyson expansion, the first order we've already used. In both cases, the first order is the same. In the interaction picture. All right. U2 This is minus infinity to infinity. U2 is not. U2 is minus infinity to infinity. dt minus infinity to t dt prime hi t prime. And for this, we don't need more. All right. So we can do the same kind of expansion the density matrix at time t for the two detectors would be equal to the trace over the field of the full timeable state. All right? So far, so good. If not, stop me and ask. So we get the original state of the three systems. We evolve it in time, and we trace out the field. Whatever is left is the state of the detectors. OK? Now, of course, we can expand that as rho 0 AB, where rho 0 AB is just the trace over the field of rho 0. OK? Plus rho 1 t ab plus rho 2 t ab plus, well, things that are of order lambda cube. Actually, I know it will be lambda fourth, but let's not assume anything. Right, this thing comes from trace over the field. OK, let's just write it in a different board. Right. So what is rho t ab1? Well, this is coming from, maybe what I should do first is show you rho t1. OK? Because when you trace out the field from that, you will get rho ab t1. So this is the state of the full, the first order correction to the state of the full system. And what do we have here? We have u1 rho 0 plus rho 0 u1. Agreed? Everyone happy with that? That's the leading order correction to rho t. It's expand u in these powers. Put one on one side, put put one on one side, put the adjoint of that on the other side, and just count all the powers that have only one lambda. The powers that have only one lambda are the ones that have one u1. Those are the ones. And of course, rho t ab1 is the trace over the field of u1, of rho t ab. Now, look at this. The field starts in the vacuum state, no? U1 has what? One interaction Hamiltonian, right? Right? The interaction Hamiltonian has one field operator, no? Yes or no? The field operator, if you expand it in a complete basis, is A plus A dagger with their modes. Agreed? The A dagger on the A on the right, on the left, annihilates it. The A dagger on the right annihilates it. The A on the right and the A dagger on the left excite one excitation. You will get a one, integrate over frequencies and so on with the modes, but a one. Agreed? So you would get states of the form things like that, or things like that. Agreed? That's what U1 is going to do for you, acting only once on each side, huh? Now, I'm tracing over the field. Does it look like a diagonal state on the field? It's non-diagonal on the field. So, for any state diagonal in the Fock basis, associated with the free Hamiltonian of that. Oh, yeah, go for it.
That equation doesn't make sense to me.
Which one?
The second one.
Yeah, no?
The phi's already traced out.
Oh, my. Thank you. The whole system,
yeah, sure.
This thing. I meant this, all right, the whole system. When you trace the field from the whole system, you get the partial system of the two detectors. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. For any state that is diagonal in the Fock basis, the one-point function of the field, let's call it Vtx, which is equal to the trace of, for any state, let's call it rho-zero field. Rho-zero field, diagonal in the Fock basis, the trace of rho-zero field is identically zero. That's the one-point function. It's a Weinmann function of one point, OK? You know the notation that I like, but I like because my mind is twisted, I admit. I use this for the one-point function. The two-point function, which is for the Weinmann function, is this. Can you guess what I would like to use for the three-point function? Right? But then again, I know I'm twisted, so. And again, for the endpoint function, right? And then you write an N here. Forget about it. I'm only half serious. I have used, though, this for the one-point function, okay, with that philosophy in mind. Anyway, so that means that trace over the field of rho 0, 1 is identically 0 if you start from a Fock state, a thermal state, anything that's diagonal in the Fock basis. All right, so this thing, rho 1 t, is identically 0 in our case. All right, we got that one. So the first, that was too nice to be true, right? Like first order perturbation theory may have worked. Not quite. You can already tell that the important terms here cannot come from the first order correction to the density matrix. The reason being that you need to mix the two detectors in order for correlations to appear. And here you only have one at a time. It's a sum. There's no product of the two. All right.
Sorry, how do you know U1 doesn't take rho not out of the Fock basis?
It does, yeah. Only that two states like this. That's what I discussed.
Oh, I see.
Right? Because it's only one field operator. It can either annihilate or excite one, only on each side. And this is non-diagonal. So when you trace, that doesn't contribute. So it's not true that the field state is 0, AB. What is true is that it's traceless. So when you trace to find the detector state, you get a 0 on that contribution. OK. Second. At second order, we get we get that one with a dagger, of course. That's not a dagger. All right, plus OK, that's the second order correction. Everyone agrees? This is the crossing of powers that gives you two lambdas. Right. This contribution, it's going to have diagonal elements because you create one on the right and one on the left, you get diagonal elements out of it. this contribution will create diagonal elements. You can have an A and A dagger multiplied, and a dagger and A dagger and A. So something that would excite and de-excite and will give you contributions that are diagonal. Same goes for this, of course. Note of warning. In the original papers, or some of the original papers dealing with harvesting, there's a problem using perturbation theory, a problem that was actually transmitted in the literature, people following those papers. The problem is that they do perturbation theory not on the on density matrix, they do it on the amplitudes, on the wave functions, if you want, with the state of the field, in the states, not the vectors, not the density matrices. And they go to second order on the amplitudes, and they compute the density matrix like taking the ket and putting the bra with it. What's the problem then? Well, they got cross terms that are of order 4, and they put them in the density matrix. I mean, everything's correct in those papers. All that I mean is that they are inconsistent in the application of perturbation theory, because they put these fourth order terms in there in the density matrix, but those fourth order terms come only from the terms that are, so if they do this, as identity, so the same thing, plus U1 plus U2, right? That's what they do. And they multiply that with the adjoint, and they start crossing terms, and they get all these, but they also get a fourth order and a third order term. The third order term is 0, the fourth order, they get it, and they put it in the density matrix. And that fourth order term, the problem with it is that, well, you're not in fourth order perturbation theory. You will also have to include this and this in order to truly have the fourth order terms, because this will cross with the identity and will give you a fourth order term. 3 would cross with 1 and will give you a third or a fourth order term as well. So they only consider the one that comes from this square. In the original papers, that don't affect them at all, that doesn't affect them. There are some follow-ups that actually used that and found out, oh, my density matrix are not trace 1, so I need to renormalize. No, the Dyson expansion preserves the trace. So no, if you have to renormalize, something's off, okay? So that's something when you read papers about harvesting, above all if they're older, this is something that people have done. So they have a full density matrix. When we talk about the matrix elements, they have one more than the ones that I'm gonna write here, okay? It's because of that, and it shouldn't be there if they were consistent with perturbation theory. All right, let's erase that. All right then, so we have that. And this thing, let me tell you, and this is something that you can compute yourselves, and actually you might have to, at least this one, for a tutorial slash problems. What do you call it? Homework, all right, yes. So tutorial and homework, right? You're gonna have to work out at the very least this one. Huh? Anyway, so let me just give you what the result is for the two detectors in general. Those are detector labels. Their value is A and B, nu and eta. This expression will also be useful when we get to communication with relativity taken into account, huh? So it's good to have it. You have nu t psi eta t prime. Well, I put the nu in the t prime because I'm putting them in the same integral, so there. Mu, nu, or mu, I call it m, sorry. M, nu, t prime, rho, detectors. So rho, 0, a, b, mu, m, eta, t. And the Wideman function, of course, we're tracing out the field, right? So we get the Wideman function because there's two fields. When there's two fields that you trace out, remember that we can always write it as a something integral over the Wideman function. So important it is, the Wideman function. Okay, so this is the Wideman of x eta t uh, right? This is a white man. Let me just write it, this white man with calligraphic style, because it's a smear white man. So I'm going to define a new white man if you want. But I'll give it to you in a minute. X new T prime. All right. Then minus. So as you can see, this is a term that comes from U1, U1, right? You have one monopole moment on the left, one conjugate monopole moment on the right, but it's self-adjoint, so same thing. And then you have the terms coming from this, which are minus infinity to infinity dt, minus infinity. This sum goes over the whole thing. It's actually minus infinity to t dt prime. And then we have mu. Yeah, we can do it like this. So we have x nu t. Chi eta of t prime. And then we have m nu of t. M eta of t. Rho 0 ab. And then this calligraphic white man, x nu. T x eta t prime. All right. Just. And then another term plus I can even factor this out. Another term that is rho 0 ab. M eta of t prime, m nu of t, and the Weinmann, x eta t prime, x nu t. And that calligraphic Weinmann, x nu t, x eta t prime, is just the pullback of the smear trajectory. Is the Weinmann function of the pullback, the Weinmann function of the field pullback to the smear trajectory of the detectors. So is the integral dn or dx integral dx prime d of the smearing function of the first detector. The smearing function of the second detector. And the Weinmann, the original Weinmann. Trace over the field of field Tx, field T prime X prime. Rho field 0. All right. So there's a definition. And this, of course, is the Weinmann function T X T prime X prime. Okay. So this is the calculation that you get. It's not too difficult, it's just tedious. But you can see where the terms come from, hopefully. This is U1, U1, right? You have one monopole on the left, one monopole on the right. That's what you would get with one Hamiltonian on the left, one Hamiltonian on the right. Then you get the U2, like from the left. You add with two monopoles. There's a prime in one of them. Has to be the second. Sorry about that. You have two monopoles acting on the left. You have two monopoles acting on the right. So this is these two terms. Okay. All right. Now, if you see the dimension of this correct, this is two for the detectors. Notation is going to drive me crazy. This is a time t ab. All right. So the notation, the density matrix of the detectors, the two detectors, what's the dimension of it? There are two-level systems. So what's the dimension? Someone said it, but I don't know. 4x4, maybe? What about 64x3? No, right? It's 4x4. So 4x4, that means that I can represent all those matrix elements. Look, these are sigma x's with faces. And I can just write the original state if it's the ground state of them. So now, assuming rho field 0 is the vacuum, the final density matrix is, for the detectors, is of this form, rho dAb, it's equal to 1 minus some term LAA, LBB, 0, 0, M star. Well, I don't care. Maybe I call this one M. I don't really care. 0, 0, M star. I get LAA, LAB, LAB star, LBB, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, plus things that are of order lambda to the power of 4, actually. I mean, I should write 3, I know, because I haven't proved to you that there's no third order contribution. But you may see it because, you know, the one-point function is 0. Having an odd number of fields in the endpoint function would give you a 0 when you trace out if you are diagonal in the Fock basis. So the contribution from all the odd point functions is 0. Okay, so the leading order contribution after this is order 4. Note of warning related to what I told you before. If you check some literature, you will find an element here that shouldn't be here. An order 4 element in here that should not be there. Okay, because if you are order 4, you also get order 4 corrections all over the place, not just there. All right? That's just a note of warning when you read literature. Okay. So the matrix has this form. The basis, okay, I didn't tell you what basis I am. So the basis I use, the representation in particular that I use, is GA, ground state A, tensor, ground state B, EA, tensor, ground B, EB, tensor, ground, sorry. What am I doing? EA, then GA, tensor, EB, and then EA, tensor, EB. All right, in this basis. So this is the element that crosses ground A, ground B with ground A, ground B. So this is the probability of remaining in the ground state, which of course is 1 minus a small thing, because you started in the ground state and you're in perturbation theory. These are the probabilities of getting A excited and B excited. And you have terms here that are coherences in these bases, terms that are correlations. Now, how much have you seen or know about measures of entanglement? Oh, question. No? I look like it, sorry. I'm trying to anticipate it too much. Measures of entanglement. How do you know if something is entangled or not? This is a bipartite system, right? Two detectors. How do you know if they're entangled or not? Do you know anything about that? Have you seen that in your courses? Aggie confirms yes. Thank you, Aggie. All right. So if one of the measures of entanglement, the one that is convenient here, I mean, you could think, how about trace one? And compute the von Neumann entropy. People call that entanglement entropy. Would that work here? Who can tell me? No, why not?
They're not pure?
Correct. This is a non-pure state. So indeed, certainly the entanglement entropy won't work. How many, what other measures of entanglement you know that may work?
Negativity.
Negativity, indeed. Negativity would work. Negativity is, quick reminder, based on Peres criterion. Peres criterion tells you, in fact, for 2 qubits, is if and only if, tells you that if you have negative eigenvalues or not non-positivity, of the partial transpose density matrix, then the state is non-separable. Now, you've seen that, Aggie? Have they seen this negative? Yeah, okay, good. So we can actually build an entanglement measure that tells us how non-positive, in a way, the partially transposed density matrix is. Okay? Yes?
Can you repeat why the first method will not work, the one that Carlos mentioned?
Oh, because this is not a pure state.
So we cannot do the trace plus the trace and then...
Oh, you can do it indeed, but think of the following. Think of a product of... Imagine that I give you a bipartite state that is like that, where, let's say, 2 qubits, and this is the maximally mixed state, this is the maximally mixed state. So there's no entanglement, it's separable, in fact, it's a product state, only that this one is a thermal state of infinite temperature, so the maximally mixed state, the maximally mixed state. If I trace one of them and compute entanglement, it will be maximal, although the state is separable. So if your state is, so the entanglement entropy, if you want, so the entropy of the partial system tells you about how much ignorance you have about the system A. And that ignorance can come from two reasons. One, you really don't know what the system is classically, like what I just told you. Or, the system is not possible to fully describe it with full certainty if there are correlations on the other system. So in this case, if you have a pure state, then it's fine, because all the ignorance, when you erase B, how much ignorance you have about A has to do with the entanglement they had, is not true if the state is mixed, because there's already ignorance in the system to begin with. Anyway, so we can compute the negativity. For that, we can compute the partially transposed density matrix and compute its eigenvalues. I can give you the list of eigenvalues. Again, I kind of get why people included this one here, because you get an eigenvalue that is order 4 and is negative. But of course, you shouldn't consider it because you're not at order 4. Order 4 is here. So if you want to consider anything order 4, you need to write this thing explicitly. So there's only one eigenvalue of the partially transposed density matrix that is negative at leading order, okay? And that eigenvalue, if the two detectors are identical, it's particularly simple. So I'm simplifying this a lot. I will give you the references when you can check these calculations, and also you can do them yourselves because you have all the machinery now to do them. So for two identical detectors, that means that the switching functions are the same, only translated in left. The shape of the switching function is the same. The shape of the smearing is the same, only centered at different positions. The gap, the difference between the two levels, is the same. Under those assumptions of identicality, the expression simplifies a lot. That's the one I'm going to give you. Of course, you can do it in general. For two identical detectors, the partial transpose density matrix, rho AB P transpose, pick your favorite. Transpose with respect to E or B, doesn't matter. Has only a simple negative eigenvalue. The negativity of rho AB, T, this is a T, sorry, I keep forgetting notation, I know it's frustrating. T AB is negativity of rho T AB is equal to, and it's super simple, let me just make sure that I get the right notation. Yes, here we go. It's as simple as L, yeah, that's called M minus L mu mu, or AA, let me just, it's identical, so why not AA? Something like that, as simple as this, plus, of course, plus, it's actually, well, if I'm rigorous, though, is the max between zero, the min between zero and m minus L AA, because if it's negative, there's no entanglement. Is that thing? If the negativity, which is the sum, remember the sum of negative eigenvalues with a minus sign. So if that's negative, there's no negative eigenvalues. Plus corrections of order lambda to the 4. Now that's kind of cool. Look at this. It's easy to interpret this, right? These are independent transition probabilities. This is kind of local noise. This is what you would get if you measure the probability of getting excited locally in atom A. So this is against negativity. And you have a correlation term, M. The correlation term is trying to get the two atoms correlated. What this is telling you is that there's a competition between the noise, the local noise, and the correlation terms. Okay, the correlation terms M are competing against the local noise terms LAA to get entanglement. So maybe you should not switch very suddenly, because if you switch suddenly, you're going to get a lot of noise. So actually, you will calculate that, which is kind of neat. Maybe your interaction should last an amount of time. Maybe you shouldn't just consider interactions that are super short. I don't know. So intuitions as to which one will win, I hope that you develop during this course, right? But basically, you have a competition between terms that include, that are actually those terms M come genuinely from U2 contributions, terms that correlately excites the two detectors. You see, U1, U1 is pure noise, kind of. Look, I mean, there's a lot of noise in it, right? U1, U1, on the one hand, excites one detector and excites the other. Huh? U2, though, generates correlated excitations of the detectors. So it intuitively makes sense that this M is corresponding to terms that correlate the atoms, whereas the LAA correspond to terms that are local and have noise, include noise in your atom. All right? Any questions? All right. So to finish this today, it'd be nice if you can go through this a little bit and get familiar with it, because it will be helpful for communication too. But this is all the math that at this point, except for your homework, this is all the math regarding this that we're going to do here. We're going to talk about the implications of this. So we're going to talk tomorrow about three things. One, how much information is there in entanglement harvesting about the structure of space-time? If I have a different space-time background, how much will this process of entanglement harvesting notice? We will discuss that is very sensitive to the geometry of the space-time that's behind. And not only the geometry, it's also very sensitive to the topology of the space-time you have behind. So if you can measure entanglement harvesting, you might be able to actually get an easier way of assessing the topology of space-time. Of course, super idealized, but we will see how that works. In particular, I will show you results with flat space-time and three different topologies: cylinder, Möbius strip, and the usual topology. So you can actually get information about geometry and topology through processes of entanglement harvesting. The entanglement structure of the field feels those, the topology and the geometry. And interesting enough, it makes sense because of your question. Like, your question is like, but the ground state has time, no, but to know about the whole thing. Indeed. So the ground state of the field, if you have a given topology of space-time, has thermalized with that topology. So there is information in the ground state of the field about that topology. Only it's very non-local. But we're accessing it in a bilocal kind of way. So there is an imprint of that thermalization information in scales that are not, of course, a trivial way to check if we have a periodic topology or something like that, a cylinder kind of topology, is just send a signal and wait. If it comes back, I know I'm in a cylinder. If it doesn't, I don't know, right? Well, you don't need to wait that much. With entanglement harvesting, you're amplifying the ability to get the information about those long-distance scales. And this kind of connects with something that is in the philosophy of RQI, which is, can we get information about scales that are far away? Typically, you will hear, well, you will never measure that because it's Planck scale. And there's no way we can get anything dimensionless with anything I have in my experiment with the Planck scale to be of order 1. Well, maybe if you use some things to your advantage, you invite more scales to the party. and you a-dimensionalize with more scales, and maybe you can pump up enough complex dimensionless quantities that can be of order one when you make it comparable, when you actually think of it in the Planck scale. So that's kind of the philosophy. Of course, this is theoretical physics, so. But we're getting there, and we will discuss that a little bit. And that, and also, can we actually measure this? Can we get Bell pairs out of entanglement harvesting? We will discuss a protocol called entanglement farming as well, which is kind of grow this until you cannot grow it anymore and see how much you can get and if you can distill it. And that's tomorrow.